Welcome to Trilawyer Talk. I'm Scott Glevsky, and I'm your host for this podcast where we speak with some of the best trial lawyers in the U.S. Today, we're very lucky we have with us David Humphreys. David is a gem of a human being and a gem of a lawyer who practices out of Tulsa, Oklahoma, but really has a national practice. He primarily sues financial institutions for abusing everyday people. Let's get started. I feel great that I'm sitting with David Humphreys, who is a phenomenal trial lawyer, phenomenal teacher to other trial lawyers, and a phenomenal, caring, and loving human being. David Humphreys has a practice that's national in scope, goes all over the country, and tries cases against companies that are, as he told me, lying, cheating, and stealing from people, primarily against financial institutions. David, thank you so much for being here.
Well, thanks for all the kind things you just said, and thanks for having me.
David, can you tell me the story of a case that had a profound impact on you?
Yeah, I can. What's profound about it is I think it made a difference. It's not often that we really get to make a difference. A lot of times, I think, all we do is teach them how to be smarter to cover up their lies and they're cheating and they're stealing. But we had a case against a company, a very, very disreputable company called Security Finance. They're still in business. They have 400 or 500 loan shops all across the country. Most folks would just drive by their stores and not even pay attention to it. You wouldn't even notice it. They're in strip malls on the outskirts of towns and in small towns all over the country. And it's a very, very profitable business. They basically don't pay any money in rent. They have really cheap furniture. They have a few employees. And their job is to get people in, vulnerable people in their shop, and to have them extend a loan to desperate people on outrageous financial terms. And the terms are so outrageous that, and so complicated the financial terms are, that I had the president of the company on the witness stand, and I said, can you explain to this jury how you calculate this interest rate on these three loans here? How'd you come up with this amount of charges? And she couldn't do it. The president of the company could not explain in simple terms. So how is the borrower supposed to understand that? We represented a 50-year-old man who lived in public housing, who had a developmental disability and had about an IQ of 70. And had no business. You could tell by talking to him that he was a simple man who did not have the capacity to understand a loan transaction, especially one like this. And they started out what we call loan flipping, where they took out one loan and he came back in, they convinced him to get another one, and then another one and another one. And when he got up to so many loans there, they sent him to one of their sister stores, and they took out more and more loans and more and more. It got to the point where he lost his home. They convinced him to pay them instead of his rent on his subsidized housing, so he became homeless. So he went to a homeless shelter, and they actually went to the shelter, picked him up, took him in their car to the loan shop so they could renew his loan again. And he thought that he was paying his loans off. He had no idea that they were just refinancing him. And the way the math works, I don't want to bore your listeners, but basically the first time you make a loan, you get almost $800. The second time, it's about half of that. And the third time, it's like $70. But you're paying the same amount of finance charges on the third and fourth loans as you do on the first one, but you get almost no cash back. So the whole game that they play is to find people who don't have any money, trap them in debt, and to do whatever is in their power to keep them in there. You know, we can talk about it, but there's a whole bunch of different ways they can do that, but they intimidate people into being trapped in debt and never being able to repay their loan.
What are the ways they do that?
Well, we were in this case, we tried this case to a jury in Oklahoma. We uncovered evidence in the case of their what do you call it, procedure manuals, for sure, was one thing. The other thing was their like reports on the loan shops. They have a district manager who would go around to the stores and look at her eight shops or whatever. And then they'd have a manager over that, and they'd have a president of Oklahoma. Her name is Susan Burroughs, I believe, if I recall correctly. But they would have these notes in the file, like, I see that you had a borrower come in who paid off their loan with a $50,000 settlement from their workers' compensation back surgery injury case, but yet you convinced them to renew. Congratulations, that's great work. Keep it up. You know, we must convince our customers. We must sell the renewal. Persistence breaks resistance. You know, these are things that they wrote, that the local newspaper, the Tulsa World, had snippets of these different things, and put a full page, not a full page, but I mean a front page article about this despicable business and what they're doing. And what we found out is they're targeting people that don't have the capacity to consent to a transaction, people that have developmental disabilities that are getting Social Security benefits, people that that don't speak English as their first language, and native Cherokee speakers in Oklahoma. One lady was 90 years old. She'd never been to a restaurant before. She was getting a Social Security check, and they were taking her entire check. Other people, you know, like, I don't know, maybe you don't have this in the big city, but in small towns, there'll be a person that everybody sees going around town with a shopping cart. You know, they're just not all there. They're the, you know, the person in town that everybody looks out for. And they would target those people, and they'd have them in their store and just take their Social Security check. So basically, as a country, as a government, or as a society, we've decided to take a certain amount of taxes and pay that to people, give our money to people that can't do better for themselves. And this company's figured out a way to take this little bit of money we give them, and through a very low cost operation, they have really no real involvement in Oklahoma or any of the other states they operate in. And they take all this Social Security money, and they suck it out of the states, and they would take it to their headquarters. And this woman flies around in a jet, has a home in Florida. It's absolutely despicable. And they're kind of laundering their money and taking it from the loan shop operation. They're putting into, I call it laundering. You might be a better word for it. That's my opinion. But they're putting into other things like hotels and things like that. You know, but Spartanburg, South Carolina's kind of the headquarters for this thing. Therefore, I don't know if it's the water or what, but there's a whole bunch of businesses based out of South Carolina that do this. I'm not sure exactly where they're located, but other companies like World, Sun, that are doing the same thing. But this one company has Continental Credit, Sunbelt Loans, West, I'm not sure of the other names. There's like three or four names. It's a, you know, it looks very low-key and under the radar, but it's really a big business, a big scam.
So how did you go about trying to discover the story of the case?
Well, this case was referred to us by some other lawyers, and we got into the case, and we listened to our client. His brother found out what was going on when he became homeless. He went to go see him in his apartment. He wasn't there, and realized that what was happening. And our client was so incapable of understanding what was happening. He thought these people were still his friends. His brother went in there and told him, you know, don't ever do this to my brother. Do not take any more of his money. Do not make any more of his loans. He doesn't understand. This is wrong. And it basically got pretty loud with him. And his brother said, he was talking to him like they were friends. He didn't understand. He said, hey, did you guys see the fireworks on 4th of July? Did you guys see those big fireworks? Wasn't that just beautiful? He's like, he has a mind of a child. His favorite thing is the state fair, going to the state fair, and he loves Elvis, and, you know, he likes to watch his shows. And we got him a I can't remember the amount, maybe $1.75 million jury verdict. And one of the press asked him what was he going to do if he got his money. He said he wanted to buy a television. I mean, he had a guardian, of course, appointed to protect him. But they, you know, we just figured out who he was. And we got their documents, figure out what they were doing. That's how we learned that they had this, it was an intentional plan to strip the little bit of money that poor folks have from them.
So how did you approach telling the story at trial?
Well, we put our client between us. I have a partner, Luke Wallace, and I. We tried this case together. We worked it all up together. We do everything, all of our cases get worked on together. And we put our client between us. And, you know, it wasn't long. He didn't testify till, it was a 3-week trial, as I recall. And he didn't testify till towards the end of it all. But he sat between us, and one day during trial, he stood up and said, well, it's 3:00. It's time for Gilligan's Island. I need to go home. I mean, it was pretty clear that he wasn't, he wasn't all there. So it really wasn't, we just told the truth.
And did you use any first person or any, how did you communicate the story?
Well, the first witness we called was our company representative. We just confronted them with their own records and their notes. And invariably they'll just dance around them and make themselves look worse instead of just saying, yes, this is horrible. We've uncovered a problem. We're going to fix it. They act like there's nothing wrong with it. So, the tension between that and what they did to this person there, including, you know, having them go to the homeless shelter. But as far as like TLC techniques, there were some moments in the trial. I apologize, it's been a long time since we tried this case, but we definitely tried to reverse roles with their witnesses on the stand and put them in our client's shoes and ask them how they would feel if someone did this to their family member, things like that.
And what did you learn from this case?
That I have a real passion for helping people that are not fully aware of their circumstances, and to protect. I love protecting people like that from financial abuse and financial predators. And I was shocked to figure out that this company had the scheme, how big it was, and how intentional it was. And so, I think word of this trial got out to some of it was in the press. So. I got contacted by a legislator in the state of Kansas who asked me to write some testimony up about the trial, which I did. And they ended up stopping this company from going into Kansas. And then that got shared with, I think, Indiana, Florida, and Arizona. It kept them out for a while. But this has been, almost 10 years ago. I think the move is underway for them to spread their tentacles into other states. So I'd encourage your listeners to be on the lookout for these predators and take care of your family members. Make sure you know what they're doing with their money. Because there's here's one thing we learned, is there's a very fine balance between allowing someone to be an adult, independent human being and not condescending them or shaming them or making them feel bad about themselves versus protecting them. So you have to have an open line of communication between your family member who's vulnerable and the family member who is a caretaker. And you can't just listen to him say everything's fine, because he was ashamed of what happened to him. And he knew all his money was gone. But he was trapped in this thing. He didn't want to show his brother what he felt foolish. So discovering that dynamic, spending time with the client, it was a big part of the case. So I guess really a lot of what I've told you is all stuff we discovered using trial lawyers' college techniques.
How do you deal with fear?
It's with me all the time. And you can make a choice to acknowledge it and push on anyway, or you can pretend it's not there, and I think it'll eat you alive if you do that. And sometimes it goes away fairly quickly in a trial, and sometimes it doesn't, but I don't try cases because I like to show off. I try cases because I have people that need me to try their case. And when you have that, I have to do it. I don't have any choice. So I either, either have fear or I don't. I just do it anyway. And I think that comes through to a jury when you're willing to be real with them and honest with them, and they see that you're struggling and it's hard for you, but you're there with them and your client anyway. They get it. They get that.
Has being a trial lawyer taken a toll on you?
I can't think of another way I'd rather make a living or anything else I'd rather do, and yes, it has. I mean, it's hard work, but anything, you know, that has meaning is not going to be easy.
So how do you deal with it?
Well, I didn't for a long time. We just worked away and pressed on. You know, we had other lawyers that knew us that just kind of laughed at us or marveled that we kept sitting there in our chairs and kept pounding it out. You know, we'd go in and try a big case and be back in our desks the next morning working on something else. And I think, you know, and we are kind of, our thing is we're always hungry. You know, we're looking for the next big case, the next big business practice. We can identify it and expose as wrongful. But I think more recently we're trying to make some more adjustments and try to live more balanced. And I think we've gotten to the point where we see what's happening. We know what's happening. We don't have to figure it out anymore. We just have to, you know, have a client and do the work we know to do already. Like, there's a huge learning curve going into it to figure out what your trial themes are. And I guess, you know, one thing I could say is that might be helpful is we do role reversals in our office, like either with a document or with the other witness, the opposing witness. It just comes up naturally, you know, and it'll spontaneously be, you work through an issue. Like, one person jumps on one side, the other person jumps on the other side, and you see which one sounds better, which one seems right.
So when you said a role reversal with the document, meaning you would actually become the document and try to discover?
Yeah, or one person would take the side of the document, the other person would take the side of the company. What could the company possibly say to excuse or justify what's in their record? So we would have every excuse possible, I think, mapped out or thought through. And then so when they show up and they give us one of those excuses, we're ready.
What's the hardest thing about being a trial lawyer?
Not trying enough cases. The hardest part of being a trial lawyer is not trying cases, because you got some corporate stall game going on. You know, we call them pretrial lawyers. They want to do everything but try a case. That's the hardest thing, I think, is doing what it takes to get a jury trial.
What advice do you have for young lawyers?
Only do it if you love it. It's not a great way to just get rich quick. Do what you love.
If you were to use three words to describe yourself, what would they be?
Not willing to answer that question. Excuse me, there may be more than three, but that's what I got for you.
What are you feeling right now?
I'm relieved that, you know, I didn't know what was coming my way, and it seemed like, hopefully it's helpful to someone. And I'm grateful. Thank you for asking me to do it.
Well, thank you for taking your time and sharing your wisdom with us. I very much appreciate it, and very glad you have a lot of good lessons and a lot of wisdom that you shared with us. Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today for Trial Lawyer Talk. If you like the show, I'd really appreciate it if you could give us a good review on iTunes, and I'd love to get your feedback. You can reach me at www.scottglovsky.com. That's scottglovsky.com. And I'd love to hear your feedback. You can also check out the book that I published called Fighting Health Insurance Denials, A Primer for Lawyers. That's on Amazon. I put the book together based on 20 years of suing health insurance companies for denying medical care to people, and it provides a general outline of how to fight health insurance denials. Have a great week, and we'll talk to you in the next episode.